Well, hello, everybody. This is your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, Diana Wiley. And I'm so pleased because, actually, for the fourth time, my guest is Dr. Stephen Schneider. He is a psychiatrist in New York City and also a sex therapist, and that combination is rare. But the thing that is really outstanding, oh, there are many things about Dr. Schneider that are outstanding, but
thank you.
You're welcome. Your book, Love Worth Making. It's really a unique and compelling book, and it's quite different from most sex books on the market. For instance, Chapter 4 is titled Selfishly Yours, and that's good because passion is selfish. Deep down, most of us want to be physically relished by someone who desires us very much. So Dr. Schneider's book is a guide to passionate, playful, and creative sex. And in fact, for this program, we've decided to talk about chapters 5, The Art of the Easy, and his chapter 6, Two Roads to Orgasm. Welcome back to this program, Dr. Schneider.
Thank you so much. You know, I really appreciate the repeat invitations, hope we can provide your listening audience with additional information that they can use tonight.
Well, I think we will. So going back to last April, my husband Brian and I were in New York City, and we actually got to have a little supper with Dr. Schneider. Where we ate was not too far from your office, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, Manhattan space is tight, so restaurants around near my office are kind of my living room. And so, we had a wonderful time.
We did, and I treasure it, and I hope that on our
especially nice meeting after speaking on the radio like this, you know,
nice
to meet you in person. And
right. We get pretty well acquainted during this show about lots of things and reflecting your book, but it's really kind of nice to go off script and just see each other. And my husband, Brian, really liked meeting you, too. He did a review for your book that made Amazon, and my review didn't make it, and they've gotten they thought, well, since we were colleagues, my review wouldn't be acceptable. I thought that was really silly, but
I don't understand that. Yeah, we now have I think 96 reviews, so we're going to crack 100 by August. So by the end of August, so we're very excited.
Of course, and again, listeners, the title is "Love Worth Making: How to Have Ridiculously Great Sex in a Long-Lasting Relationship." And the best place for them to get your book is probably on Amazon.com, but
Amazon.com. You just dial in "Love Worth Making," or you can go to my own book page, which is loveworthmaking.com. And actually, on loveworthmaking.com or anywhere on my website, you can actually there's a little orange button where you can read Chapter 1 for free.
That's great.
Yeah. And as you know, it's a very, very different book. This is one of the only sex books that I know that actually begins in Chapter 1 on a subway car.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I did not reread the beginning, so tell me.
Yeah, it begins on the B train, which is the train that passes right outside my office at 72nd and Central Park West, and it goes all the way down to Brighton Beach, which is the place I used to take my kids when they were little on a Sunday. And so it begins on the train coming back from Brighton Beach. We're all kind of tired, and everybody's with their kids and everything. And there's a couple by the door, and they're just kind of making out by the door. And it's clear that they're really just so absorbed in the moment of what's happening. And they're not doing anything obviously improper, but there's just aura that's spreading throughout the entire subway car. And all the adults on the car are watching this couple because it's clear that they're enjoying real authentic sexual arousal. Obviously, there's something very appealing about authentic sexual arousal. Everybody likes that. And
I love the way you open your chapter one where you describe this. I just turned to it. I really thought Mae West was a woman ahead of her time.
She definitely was in many, many ways.
I love what she said, but anyway, you have her quoted at the beginning of your...
Sex is emotion in motion.
Yeah.
And that's exactly true. That's what people forget. Forget that you know, when you think of a great sex, it's really the emotions involved that really make it great. So the book is that's the jumping off point, talking about this couple in the subway car, and what are the emotions that they're involved in? And it talks about an analysis of what sexual arousal really feels like. Because people don't often think about that. Okay, what does it really feel like when I'm sexually aroused? And for most people, there's this quality of getting absorbed in the experience. So you're not really thinking about anything else if you're doing it right. And hopefully losing some IQ points so you get kind of stupid, you know.
Great sex
really makes you very, very stupid.
But it's temporary, right?
Temporary. It gets better afterwards. And the speculation is I wondered whether this couple was going to miss their subway stops. Because then you know you're really aroused when you've missed your subway stops and you arrive somewhere far uptown not knowing really where you are or what happened to you. So
It seems like that couple was practicing what you describe in the book, and I'm hoping we can get into this a little bit more, but it's about simmering.
Absolutely.
And
you describe they're definitely simmering.
High school students who are catching a kiss between classes and...
A little more than a kiss, actually, but yes.
Yeah, a little more than a kiss.
So simmering...
They're practicing simmering.
In case we didn't talk about it in a previous show, simmering is one of the techniques I talk about in the book, and it's the world's easiest sex therapy technique because it only requires a minute. You're a high school student, high school couple, boyfriend and girlfriend in between classes, and you have a couple of minutes in between classes, meet at one of your lockers, hold each other, make out a little bit, breathe together, stare deeply into each other's eyes, inhale each other's scent, feel each other a little bit, and then the bell rings, and you go off to your class feeling just a little buzz, and you don't really understand what's going on in class for the first 10 minutes because you just got very stupid there for a minute. And that's the desired state of affairs. And any couple can do that at any time. And I'm constantly telling couples in my office, it's okay, you can get excited. It doesn't mean you have to have sex. You can enjoy excitement for its own sake. The mnemonic I use sometimes in the office is FIOS, like Verizon FIOS. It's F-I-O-S, for its own sake. Just do it for its own sake. It doesn't have to lead to anything. And this brings us to the chapter you wanted to talk about today, which is the art of the easy.
And right, because ideally...
The idea is that simmering is easy. It's easy because it's going to happen naturally if you're attracted to each other. It's going to happen naturally, and all you have to do is let it happen and get out of your own way. So if you get out of your own way, it'll happen. But that's what Masters and Johnson discovered in the 60s, that the big problem was people were just getting in their own way.
Right.
So one of the things...
And that includes something else you talk about in the chapter, ants.
We're going to get to ants...
We'll get to ants in a minute, but let's lead up to it because...
Hold on, yeah.
We're going to talk about play and the art of the easy, and you open that chapter with the essence of good foreplay is to enjoy yourself. I think a lot of people forget that sex is play and sex should be fun and ideally, right?
Well, I would say it's a little more complex than that. Is it okay if I talk a little bit about this?
Of course, you're my guest, and I want you to use the time the way you want to.
I would say it'd be a little more accurate to say that sex is infantile. And
yes,
infantile is both playful and serious. If you look at kids playing, they're playful, but they're also serious. Or even go back farther, a baby at the breast, it's serious. It's blissful, but it's also serious. And there's some serious quality that gets into real passionate lovemaking. You don't want people joking around. You don't want to see a lot of, cutting up and so forth. It's playful and serious. It's one of the things that about sexuality or sexual arousal that's paradoxical by ordinary adult standards. You know, it's playful and serious at the same time. It's relaxing and exciting at the same time. That's really weird. It makes no sense from an adult point of view, but it only makes sense if you realize that it's a regression to an earlier state of mind because early on in life, you know, earliest childhood and infancy, playful and serious are all mixed together, and relaxing and exciting are all mixed together.
Mm-hmm.
And the affects haven't yet sorted themselves out into the little silos and categories. So
I like how you put that, silos and categories.
Yeah, we don't really have those.
Compartmentalization, you know, that emotion. We tend to do as we grow into adults, right?
Yeah, and because, you know, the emotions and physical sensations aren't really so distinguished from each other in early childhood either.
Mm-hmm,
the physical sensations are emotion. The breast in the mouth is happiness. It's not it makes you feel, quote, happy. And similarly, during really, really good sex, it's not that the penis and the vagina makes you feel happy. It's the penis and the vagina is happiness. The physical and the emotion get fused. So given that,
yeah, like
the
that.
purpose of foreplay is to create that space where that regressive experience is going to happen. And so a lot of couples don't know that because they think the purpose of foreplay is to get the woman wet. And you hear this all the time. It makes me, drives me crazy. You hear this all the time. Women need a little more time in foreplay to get ready for intercourse. Oh, who cares? It's for. It's not to accomplish the deed. It's instead to create that space for that regression to occur so that you get genuinely aroused. Am I making sense?
I find it fascinating, and yes, you're making sense. And I think that we could interject another model here very easily, because transactional analysis with the parent, adult, and child ego states and the transactions that occur. So in the parent ego state, you're the critical parent, typically, or the nurturing parent, but the critical parent, we'll come back to that. The adult ego state is where we are right now. We're exchanging information in the moment. And the child ego state is the playful child or the rebellious child. Well, lots of people have such an overactive critical parent that when their playful child wants to come out to play and be sexual, they'll often drink or take drugs to put the critical parent to sleep so the child can come out to play. Does that fit for you?
Well, it does. It does. And I think that when transactional analysis first got going, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, they were talking about interactions between people.
That's true.
So they were talking about, you know, one person's internal parent talking to the other person's internal child. I think, as you say, when we talk about sexuality, we're really talking about one's ordinary adult self talking to one's sexual self, which does have childish aspect. So I think that you want to be on good terms with your sexual self. And you want to do the same thing that any good adult does or when they're in a parent role, which is to give their sexual self reasonable limits and boundaries and at the same time be encouraging and positive and a lot of acceptance and support. And if you give those things, then I think you're enacting the same kind of relationship with your sexual self as a good parent does with a child. That's the way I would
phrase it. As a good parent does with a child. Those are such good points. Spot on.
Thank you. Because, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we're not infantile, and the role of the infantile within our lives is an interesting one. We do take on infantile regressions sometimes for soothing or even for healing. For instance, mass experiences like concerts where people get in rhythmic things together. That's an infantile regression. Going to an amusement park. You know, somebody once, Michael Balint, British psychoanalyst, wrote in the 50s, he says, you know, it's really interesting about amusement parks. They never have healthy food. You know? It's always like really fattening stuff
like
funnel cake and, you know, and beignets and stuff like, you know, it's always this really garbagey food. And there's something about being in an amusement park where it's just like all about like, yes, 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 I want that now.
You're right.
You never see tofu.
And give me the sugar high. I don't care. That feels great.
Exactly. You never see tofu at an amusement park, right?
I never thought about that.
Yeah, no, it's not my original thought. He wrote this, and he says, and the other thing you see in amusement parks is very fascination with movement and with going off balance. Rides where you're upside down, that kind of thing. So you get that some kind of disorienting kind of thing, and there's thrill and there's adrenaline and there's immediate satisfaction. And the other thing that happens in amusement park is there's risk and you gamble things, and so there's all this interesting, funky stuff that goes on in an amusement park, and people kind of like the idea of kind of you know, just letting their adult just kind of be off duty for a while, and they can just indulge a little bit. The other thing that's interesting in amusement park is there's this interplay between safety and danger. So you're on a ride, it looks a little dangerous, but you know it's really safe. And that's there in sexuality, too, because ideally there is a little bit of an off-balance quality to it, but it's within a overall framework of safety. The safety kind of anchors it. So, again, you're playing with these contradictions, which are contradictory from an adult perspective, but from an infantile perspective, they make sense because they just have to do with how everything is all mixed up back then. So, anyhow, long lecture
that
on that.
That is fascinating. I've never heard that analogy with amusement parks, but it makes sense.
The book by Michael Balint is called Thrills and Regressions.
Okay, Michael Balint, how do you spell that?
B-A-L-I-N-T. Do you remember Freud's protege, Sandor Ferenczi? One of his students was Sandor Ferenczi, who was one of the first people to explore, like, child abuse, and he was a really pioneering kind of guy. And Ferenczi was Balint's analyst. So it was Freud analyzed Ferenczi, Ferenczi analyzed Balint. And Balint had some really funky stuff. Thrills and Regressions, great book.
And Regressions, okay.
So anyway, let's get back to sex.
But you made already the analogy between some of that with sex, we're taking some risks.
Sure.
And we're letting go. And I think, you know, ideally, if we're going to, now jumping ahead to the next topic a little bit, but if we're going to have an orgasm, we need to feel safe. We need to feel safe.
I want to hold off on orgasms until...
We are. But but I'm just pointing out that you need to feel safe for... you have to take some risks, but you also need to feel comfortable and safe.
I would say safe but not too safe.
Safe enough what?
Safe but not too safe.
But not too safe.
Yeah. Nobody wants to go on the ride if it's absolutely safe.
Yeah. But what about the overactive amygdala that maybe gets when an adult has had a traumatic childhood, maybe the amygdala gets overwired for anxiety and fear? My experience is that the amygdala really has to take a little nap for people to have good sex.
Yeah. It's a complicated one. As you know, I'm not so big on the neuroanatomy kind of aspect because you know, people sometimes say it's my amygdala when they're really saying is I just feel very agitated. So 20 years ago we had another name for it, and 20 years from now there'll be something else, you know. Certainly the amygdala seems to be in there, but I think people often use it as like a metaphor. But the people who've been traumatized, now that's a whole different thing, because that can go in two directions. on the one person, on one hand, people who are traumatized can be very, very, very oriented towards safety. On the other hand, people who are traumatized can be very, very oriented towards danger. So it can kind of go all different directions. You can also get all sorts of acting out and people putting themselves in all sorts of risky situations, or people who are very, very afraid. And that's what can make it very confusing. Sometimes it's both. So you're right.
Sometimes
people who have been traumatized, they need to be very, very safe, often for a very, very long time before they can do anything else. Yeah, it's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk
and
to them about...
Well, and if you think about it, if they've had sexual abuse, as a child, their boundaries and their sense of trust has been violated.
Yeah, yeah. What I always say...
Their boundaries about their bodies.
What I say in the book is that people who've been sexually abused very often don't really feel a full sense of ownership of their sexual self.
And they often have out of body experiences because that's where they went when they were abused.
There was that too.
I mean,
there's that too.
Disassociate.
The dissociating, but also that they don't have a full sense that their sexual self is something they can do what they want with. Sometimes they have a feeling that it just kind of exists for other people and that they have to just kind of go somewhere else while sex is happening. I had a patient, a gay guy, who used to feel that he was just responsible for making sure that his partner had an orgasm, and that was what it was all about. And at a certain point, after a while, he suddenly had this eureka moment. He says, wait a minute. This is supposed to be for me. This is supposed to feel good for me. And it was an important moment for him, as I think it is for a lot of people, especially many men. They don't realize that they're supposed to be getting something out of the experience too. You know, men naturally think of everything as a job, so they think, "Well, I'm going to be doing the job." There's a quote that I use from one of my favorite sex writers, Wendy Strugar. In my book in the chapter 5, and she says, it's not uncommon for me to get a random text from my kids' teenage friends inquiring about sexual issues. One text that made me laugh out loud recently asked, "Does fingering even work?" And I thought to myself, this is perfect. I put it in the book because a lot of guys do this. I have guys in my office today going, all right, how do you get a woman turned on? Does fingering even work? And you go, no, that's not the way it's supposed to be. You're not supposed to be trying to get her turned on because that's artificial and it's not passionate. And very few women really enjoy that on some level because, you know, women, they're human beings, they're sensitive. They realize that the guy's trying to accomplish something. And so they go, okay, well, is it working? The woman's wondering if it's working too. And everybody's just kind of watching it and seeing if it's going to work. And that's obviously not erotic. And it leads to anxiety because the woman and the man, he's going, I don't know, how long is this going to take before do we see whether this works?
Mm-hmm.
And she's going, well, I hope that it works before his hand gets tired, or otherwise he's going to get upset and I got to deal with him being frustrated. And sooner or later, the whole thing grinds to a halt.
Yeah.
So what I tell people, and this is on page 1 of my book, is if it feels like work, don't do it.
Yeah.
Instead, foreplay should be
stealthy. That's very reassuring advice for, I'm sure, a lot of people.
Good. So fingering is not supposed to work. If it feels like work, absolutely just stop it. And where this comes up a lot is around discussions of oral sex.
Yes.
Because
talk about that, because what you say is unique to most sex books. But to talk about that, yes.
Most textbooks talk about giving your partner pleasure, giving your partner the most wonderful orgasm they ever had in their life. And I look at that, and based on people I see in the office, I think that sounds the most boring thing I could ever imagine. Because somebody who just wants to give you pleasure, that's usually not that erotic. I mean, it could be nice, but it's usually not that erotic. Someone who wants to selfishly take pleasure from you, now that's erotic. If you watch these, you know, blowjob videos that a lot of guys, I hope I can say that on the radio.
Oh, sure, you can.
I can say blowjob video on the radio.
Absolutely.
If you watch these blowjob videos that a lot of guys watch, the fascinating thing, first of all, she's this beautiful woman, and her hair and her makeup are terrific and everything, and she's got a rocking body, and he's got this huge penis, and she's just, you know, all over it with her mouth. And what often guys find erotic about that is that she's so into it. because that's the thing that they often don't experience at home with their partners. And the reason is not that many women are really that passionate about giving guys blowjobs. I mean, you know, they'll do it if it's exciting, and it can be exciting a little while, but they're not going at it like the women in porn. So what's erotic is the fact that...
I just wanted to recall here, to interject, that a study, this was a small study, a study done of 500 men. They said, they were asked, what's your ideal for a female lover? And they said, a woman who really shows enthusiasm and will initiate sex from time to time.
Okay.
So that enthusiasm factor is huge, and I know that's a big part of pornography for lots of men. And then they don't have to also worry about a lot of my patients, you may have this too, that the man will experience PE, or ED, erectile dysfunction, or anyway, when he's with a partner, but when he's alone and masturbating to porn, he experiences none of that because he doesn't have to. He feels he doesn't have to please the fantasy woman on the screen.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because we could talk endlessly about this. But let me get back to the subject. Which is
oral sex.
And what oral sex is for. The ideal female partner for most men is a woman who loves oral sex. She just loves to have the guy's penis in her mouth. Now, obviously, that's it's kind of a thing that you either like it or you don't. Some women, they just adore it. Most women, they could take it or leave it. And there are a lot of women who just, it's really not their thing. They don't want a penis in their mouth. So that's a bit of a frustration for most guys. The contrary is very interesting. Cunnilingus, in most progressive communities, has become to be seen as mandatory. I'm on Twitter, and there are people on Twitter, female sex writers, who wrote, if a guy won't go down on you, throw him out of bed.
Right.
I think to myself, well, what if it were reversed? What if a man was saying, if a woman won't give you a blowjob, throw her out of bed? Doesn't really work, right?
Right.
But cunnilingus has become to be seen as mandatory. A man has to show that he's sensitive and interested in her pleasure by going down on her.
Yeah.
And that's really not very fair. Some guys love cunnilingus, and they just love being down there. Some guys love that more than anything else. And some guys, it's just not their thing. Just like
not
for some
thing.
Women, having a penis in their mouth is not their thing, even though they may be attracted to them in all other ways. So, unfortunately, the phrase giving someone oral sex, I think, is the source of a lot of the problem. Because ideally, as I say in the book, it should be taking oral sex. You should be taking oral sex. And one of my favorite sex books, She Comes First by Ian Kerner, which is a guide to oral sex.
Classic.
He says,
it's great.
Before you go down on a woman, you should recite some affirmations to her. And the first affirmations, I don't know these chapter and verse, but the first affirmation is, I'm doing this for me, not for you. Now, that's a wonderful affirmation for a woman to hear, because at that point, there's no pressure on her to do anything. She doesn't have to get excited.
Right.
She doesn't have to have an orgasm. She can just have the experience. And that's one of the main things we're going to get to when we get to chapter 6 on orgasms, is you want to just have the experience and not get in your own way. If a guy's doing it to please you, you've always got to think, oh, is he getting tired? Is he getting bored? If a guy's doing it because he likes it, then you don't have to worry because his needs are taken care of. You know who I first learned this from?
I think that's excellent, and it's very true.
You know what? Thank you. You know who I first learned this from was, did you see the movie The Sessions?
Of course.
Where this sex surrogate, Cheryl Cohen Green, played by.
Yes, she's
Helen
a real person. I briefly have met her at a conference.
Okay. She treats this guy who's quadriplegic from polio.
Yes.
And she put out an autobiography a while ago. It was called An Intimate Life. And it's a wonderful book. We corresponded a little bit, and I reviewed her book on my website. And it's a wonderful book. And one of the things is she talks about her previous husband, whose name was Cohen. She was married to Cohen, and then she was married to Green. That's Cheryl Cohen Green. And she said the thing about Cohen, he was a bit of a whack job. But he had this thing which was really an epiphany to her when she had sex with him, which was that he was completely preoccupied with his own experience. He wasn't trying to do anything to her. And she said it was so liberating because she could just do the exact same thing. She could be preoccupied with her own experience as well. And that's the thing that a lot of people miss out on when they feel that sex has to be generous, has to be thoughtful, you have to be considerate of your partner's pleasure. Yeah, those are true, obviously. But you miss out if you don't really get that raw, selfish passion aspect. And she said with him, he was just so passionate. It was so liberating. He wasn't really preoccupied with her. He was really just in his own pleasure. So, end of sermon.
Well, and then that backs up what you say in one way or another a lot in your book, and it's okay to be selfish kind of idea.
I thought of entitling the whole book Selfishly Yours, but I decided they'd be a little tricky for people because you got to kind of get into the concept to understand it. Otherwise, you think you're telling everybody to be a predator or something, which I'm obviously not doing. So,
exactly, but you make a very good point, and most sex therapists writing books don't make that point.
No, they don't get
it. Most do not. Yes.
You wanted to talk about ants, which I think is practical because
we can talk about ants, and then I'd like
then
to
we're
go
finally
going to
get the orgasm
to the two step. Yeah.
We're finally going to get
and
the
two step is part of the roads to orgasm.
We're going to get there
let's
too.
Let's talk. We're,
all right.
Yeah.
So let me take the driver's seat here if I can. So we're going to talk about ants.
Of course.
And ant is a phrase from cognitive therapy, and ANT stands for automatic negative thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody has automatic negative thoughts. I like to say they're just weeds in the lawn of the mind. They happen naturally. And one of the things that we do in psychotherapy is just pull up weeds. Oh, that's a negative thought. Does that make any sense? No, not really. Let's get rid of it. Unfortunately, during sex, people have automatic negative thoughts. And unfortunately, during sex, you can't really easily stop everything and say, well, let me just get out my cognitive worksheet and start looking at my automatic negative thoughts and
check
the reality value and so forth like that. Yeah, it doesn't really work. Instead, what you have to do is you have to take a little bit more of a Buddhist approach or the mindfulness approach, which is based on Buddhism originally, which says, as D.T. Suzuki, great teacher of Zen Buddhism in San Francisco in the 50s and 60s, said, he said, let your thoughts come into your home, but don't serve them tea. And that's the approach that I use in the book, which is, okay, I'm having a negative thought. I'm thinking she's not really turned on by me. Okay. I guess I'm having that thought. Well, I don't want to spend too much energy on that one. And you basically don't serve it any tea. And you say, let me take myself back to the experience. So that's the best way in general. And, you know, in the book, we have an example of a woman who's preoccupied with bad thoughts about herself. She says, I'm sexually broken. She had had some very traumatic experiences.
Yeah.
And whenever she has that feeling, I'm sexually broken or there's something wrong with me, she just says, oh, yeah, that's just my negative thoughts going on. Give me a second. Hold me on. Hold me. It'll pass. And that's really the best way to do it. Not get emotionally involved with them too much.
Yeah. I think in your book you talk about your patient Jill, and she starts to lose her arousal, and then she's able to say to her husband, I'm just obsessing. Hold me a minute until it goes away.
Exactly.
You're right,
which is the way to do it.
Does.
Just in a matter of fact, don't serve it tea. Don't give it too much emotional attention. And then draw yourself back to the experience. And the nice thing about sex is that you do have the physical aspect of the experience to anchor it. So it's not like you're just meditating or something. Instead, you're really involved, and hopefully there is something that's actually turning you on. So you have a wonderful way of getting out from under the tyranny of the ants, which is kind of go somewhere else, which go into the sexual experience. Another place where this comes up, and I talk about it in the back of the book, there's actually an appendix section of common sexual situations where people get negative thoughts. Is a guy who's having intercourse, and at some point something bothers him. He thinks about a meeting he has with the boss the next day or something, and he starts to get soft. And what do you do? Unfortunately, what most guys do is they try and pump faster at that point, figuring they just need a little friction. Unfortunately, the penis doesn't like that because it feels like demand. Come on, stay hard. Are you going to stay hard?
Demand, yeah.
Penis usually just says, the hell with this. I don't want to do this. You know, it gets even softer. Instead, the thing to do is you bury your penis deep inside your partner's body, take a deep breath, go, oh, yeah, this is a negative thought. I'm just not going to bother with it. And go back to whatever turned you on about your partner during foreplay. You know, just kind of hit rewind there. And then when you get happy again, your penis will register that happiness in the way that penises register happiness, which is they get hard. So just another example.
You need to be relaxed to get that erection.
It's relaxed, yeah, but that's using adult language. Infantile language is it's in that funky state between relaxation and excitement.
Right. Well, this makes sense. And you know, I don't own a penis because I'm a woman, obviously, but as I understand it, most men say, well, my penis never lies. It reflects the truth, what's going on inside of me and outside.
Absolutely, and because the penis is the most vulnerable part of a man's sexual response. So it does never lie. It's the most honest part of the body. The equivalent for a woman, her desire. My desire never lies. I'm either interested or I'm not.
Right.
And not much she can do about that. Although a lot of books try to figure out ways to manipulate desire. Well, let's just go to a sexy bar and pretend we're not married, or let's get a sex toy, or let's get this sex novelty of the month thing where this box will arrive and it's something funky that we can do, or blindfolds or something like that. And I go, oh, man, gag me with a spoon. That is just like you're monkeying with your desire. You're trying to, force it in some fashion. And that's ridiculous. That's the equivalent of a man stroking his penis harder to try and get it hard. What you really want to do is stop monkeying with it and just listen to it. So I tell people that if you're just looking for novelty to soup up your desire, it's the equivalent of trying to keep a kid happy by entertaining them. Eventually, the kid's going to get just miserable because he thinks everybody has to entertain him all the time, and you're going to be exhausted. Better to just give the kid safe boundaries, put him out in the playground, and say, have a good time. That way you don't...
Absolutely. I don't think a lot of parents realize that, so that's very good.
I think a lot of parents learn that pretty quick.
Okay, yeah.
Same thing with your same thing with your sexual self. You don't have to monkey too hard to keeping it happy. All that you have to do is just really kind of pay attention to the subtleties of your experience. What am I feeling right now? And this gets into chapter 6, which is where we wanted to go, which is mindfulness.
Right.
Because the definition of mindfulness, as you know, is just paying attention to the present moment without judgment. And if you look at the parts of that statement, sex is all about all that stuff. Sex is all about paying attention. It's all about the present moment. That's the only place it happens. And
it's
all about letting go of judgment. So if you're doing that, it's a very good foundation for sex. So, and it doesn't matter what you pay attention to. The exercise that I have in Chapter 6 for couples is called the two-step. And what that basically is step two is having sex, and step one is a mindfulness practice. You go to bed with the intent to do nothing. That's what you want to do, do nothing. And like they used to say in Zen Buddhism, don't just do something, sit there. So you're just going to bed to do nothing, and you lie in bed naked or nearly naked together under the covers doing nothing, breathing, being aware of the temperature of your body, being aware of the pressure of your body against the mattress. And then once you feel you've felt what you feel like, be aware of the presence of your partner, and if there's anything that's of erotic interest in your partner, you want to tune in and be aware of it and just experience it with no goal in mind other than to experience your partner's erotic body. And this is very similar to what Masters and Johnson learned to do with their patients back in the 1960s. And it works. You know, it's a little bit like mindful eating. Most people, if they do mindfulness or yoga or any other kind of attention-focusing discipline, and they go have a meal afterwards, they go, oh, yeah, food tastes a lot better. Well, sex is a lot better, too, because you've kind of opened your awareness channels. So, I mean, without getting
and you've slowed down
about it. Yeah, and slow down, as a matter of fact, which all of us need to do these days because we all go so fast. Can we talk about orgasm finally?
So fast. I wanted to ask you, so on just before you talk about the two-step, you write in Two Roads to Orgasm, Chapter 6, Getting to Yes, you write, it's not uncommon for a mother of small children to be worried that she'll be too distracted if one of her kids needs her. And as I understand it, women have typically bigger corpus callosums so they can access the right and left hemispheres of their brain, and it would be for a situation just like this, that I'm being sexual, but I also want to be able to listen for my children if they need me. So she's distracted.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. You know, as you know, I don't usually look at the neuroanatomy that way. But
I'm bringing that up again.
You love that stuff.
I do. So she has a bigger corpus callosum. She can access right and left hemispheres.
Readily. It is a common experience that most parents have had. There's a 2-year-old in the baby's room. And there's a monitor. Mm-hmm. They know what's going on. And mm-hmm. baby's fine. And the couple is having sex, and there's a noise from the other room. And the mm-hmm. woman says, we've got to stop. Something's going on. I've got to check it out. And the guy goes, oh, it's fine. It's fine. Mm-hmm. He's not worried mm-hmm. about it at all. Because guys, you know, they just naturally focus a little bit better, a little more sharply. And women are just like, you know, whether you call it the corpus callosum or the right hemisphere, but they're generally gathering a whole lot more data. So it's a thing. And the woman said, how mm-hmm. can you be so thoughtless? And the guy says, oh, why do you have to be such a pain in the neck? You know, we never get a chance to relax, you know.
You know, one of your great strengths, Dr. Stephen Schneider, is that, you know, you talk so colloquially about this and with humor.
Thank you.
And
you got to when
you write
about sex.
This way too, and it
there's
makes
nothing worse
it
than a
much
serious
more accessible.
What?
Well, write colloquially and conversationally, and because you write with humor, it just makes your information so much more accessible to the average layperson.
Thank you so much. I just figured I wanted people to have fun with it, because you know if you can't have fun reading a sex book, I mean that's a sin. I see so many sex books.
I agree with you.
They have things, you know, sex books, they have statistics in sex books. And they go, oh, my God, what is a statistic doing in a sex book? Sexual mind doesn't know anything about statistics. It never took math. Or you'll see lists in a sex book, which is the worst. Make sure you talk about these 5 things. And I go, oh, my God, you're killing me. So there's no list. There's no statistics. There's just talking about stuff. And hopefully it'll be funny and enjoyable.
Well, you do write 3 things that are good for sex, but you keep it brief. And this is on page 71 in your book.
I got to see.
This is like mindfulness, sex is all about paying attention. It's all about the present moment, and it's all about being without judgment. That is.
I slipped up there. There's a little bit of a list. Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I like it a lot.
All right.
You know, because a lot of my patients, clients, you know, they kind of like being able to take away, you know, they say when you're doing public speaking, you should not try to cover more than 3 major facts or things you want the audience to go away with.
I've had trouble with public speaking, actually. Sometimes I would do 3 facts, and I say the 3 facts, and I say the first 2, and then I forget the 3rd. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. It's really dangerous to say the 3 facts. You know?
Yeah. You're terrific. Really. Thank
you. Likewise. Likewise.
Oh, thank you.
Can we talk about orgasms finally?
We're going to. Let's talk about it because.
Okay. At long last.
Yeah, the two paths.
The two roads to orgasm.
Two roads.
And two roads to orgasm. There's mm-hmm. the high road and there's the low road.
Mm-hmm.
So the high road is what Masters and Johnson discovered when they had people come and masturbate and have sex in the lab in the 1960s. They discovered that there was something where they would subjects would get excited, and all the dials and everything would show that they were getting excited, and they'd just cruise around in this state of intense excitement for a little while. And they called that plateau. It was like the high
yeah.
plateau, like Santa Fe or something. It's like a mile high, and you know, it's a plateau.
yeah.
And that's the heart of great sex. When people remember the greatest sex of their lives, they're usually remembering that plateau experience. Yeah, we were like a mile high, you know, and just we were lost there on that plateau. And then at the end of plateau, orgasm. And orgasm signals that it's over. So that's the high road to orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
When you're truly aroused, or to talk about something we talked about earlier in the hour, when you're really dumb and happy and you've lost a lot of IQ points and you don't really care
right.
who's knocking at the door or anything like that, and you're going to miss your subway stops and all that stuff. There's also the low road to orgasm where mm-hmm. you're really not that excited at all. You're down at sea level. But, you know, mm-hmm. if you get the right fantasy and the right kind of friction or the right kind of electricity in the right kind of place, yeah, you could squeak one out. But those usually aren't very good.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They're really not very good. And so I say in this chapter, Two Roads to Orgasm, the intensity and satisfaction in an orgasm is usually dependent on how aroused you were before you got the orgasm. So
that's
orgasms
simmering, right? Simmering can help with that.
It can, because it gives you practice being aroused. But I'm talking about where you're really spending some time up there. And it's the duration and intensity of the arousal that determines the quality of the orgasm. So you're going to get a really good orgasm after a really good plateau. And if you're not having any plateau and you're just down at sea level and just, you know, with a vibrator and some fantasy or whatever, and you're not really that into it, you're just trying to get an orgasm so you can get to sleep, the orgasm is usually not much to write home about. So that's really, really important. And so the reason I write this is because a lot of couples think of sex as what happens when both people have an orgasm. So they're going to bed, they know it's going to end when they both have orgasms, they're both tired, and they know if he does this to her and she does this to him, they're both going to come. And that becomes sex. Unfortunately, that leads to a lot of loss of sexual desire because it's not very good sex. They don't really get any elevation, they don't get any arousal, and the orgasms they get are not that great. So basically what they're doing is, as I say in the book, it's like they're going out and just having dessert without having the whole meal.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Mm-hmm.
What you really want is you really want to have the foreplay, which is like the appetizers, and you go, well, these appetizers are really good. You know, this is a great place. I love this place. And then you remember that you ordered an entree. Oh, God, I had an entree, too? Oh, it's fantastic. We get intercourse, too? Great, bring it on. And then you're almost full, and then they bring the dessert tray around, and you go, oh, my God, I forgot. We got a dessert, too. Oh, I really love this place. This is terrific. I'm coming back here. So that's the way it should go.
And for people that really, really like dessert, isn't that a treat?
Exactly, exactly. So I said to one colleague of mine, I said, you know, orgasm is just dessert. He goes, wait a minute, I like dessert. So so this is the common misunderstanding about premature ejaculation, because a guy with prematurity, he'll come, you know, within 2 seconds of penetration, and his wife will say, I feel so cheated. I mean, he got his pleasure, but I didn't get mine. In reality, he didn't get his pleasure either, because he didn't really get the chance to be very excited. And if you ask guys with premature ejaculation, they'll say those orgasms really aren't very good because they weren't preceded by much real arousal. He was like somebody at a meal. He, you know, he sits down, he has a couple of bites of salad and a piece of his roll, and then they take everything away and bring him dessert.
and get the main meal.
You see, he didn't get the main meal.
Or the dessert, but a real dessert. He didn't get the main meal because he couldn't really
enjoy it. He gets the dessert, and then he loses his erection, and they bring him his coat and the check, and, you know, he's got to cut a cab in Manhattan. It's a lousy night. So it's a teaching
Plus,
point.
Plus, there's so much shame involved, typically, with men who have premature ejaculation.
There's
a lot of shame.
There's also misunderstanding on the parts of their partners that the person with premature ejaculation was selfish. He just wanted to get his orgasm. No. He wanted the meal, too. He just couldn't get it because his threshold for getting an orgasm is so low that the minute he gets a certain amount of excitement, it's just going to come automatically. So what I do in my office is, you know, I'll recommend the usual kind of behavioral things, and if they don't work, I just, you know, after appropriate discussion, because it's off-label, I recommend guys take serotonin reuptake inhibitors, like, you know, Zoloft or Paxil or something. And that just raises their threshold so they can enjoy the meal without having dessert arrive too fast.
And do you prescribe that where they take just a small amount just before they intend to have sexual relations? Or are they taking it...
Four hours before... And depending
four
on
hours
patient,
before.
Not necessarily a small amount, sometimes a big amount.
We used to prescribe
them every day for guys.
Yeah.
And most of the research that was done was giving it every day because it's a little easier to control that way. But these days, I think, you know, there's no reason to really get into that. It works on an as-needed basis for most guys, so that's usually what we do.
Do you find that a patient who's been prescribed Zoloft or Paxil and takes it 4 hours before, and it helps with his anxiety with sexual relations. Do you find that a guy like this, eventually, the pill will be confidence building, and eventually he can have sex without it?
No, absolutely not.
Interesting. Say more, because you know your medicine.
He's born with a very low orgasm threshold. Often these guys discover their first orgasm at the age of 7 or something. I had one patient discovered his first orgasm at the age of 7. He was rope climbing, and the friction of the, through the rope again through his jeans, it gave him an orgasm. He almost fell off the rope. Well, he didn't know what was happening. And he just had a very low threshold. And so the lower your threshold, the more likely that you'll discover orgasm earlier in life. And orgasm threshold is, we think it's to some degree hereditary. And tends to run in families. And, you know, there's nothing this guy, it's not from masturbating the wrong way, it's not from hurrying, it's not because you hate women, it's not any of those things. It's just that's how you're wired. And so it's like sneezing. You know, orgasms are a lot like sneezes. You know, you have a feeling of, okay, there's a lot of pepper in the air right now, it could make somebody sneeze. And then you're feeling, you know, it's really a lot of pepper. You know, I'm going to sneeze and there's nothing I can do about it. And then afterwards, you go, oh, that was a good sneeze. You know, so if you understand sneezes, you understand orgasms. Some people sneeze a lot more easily than others. And so what the medicines do when they work is they raise that threshold, that biological threshold, so that your orgasm threshold isn't so low anymore. It's now in the mid-range, and you can actually enjoy sex without always having to keep your arousal low. So if such a guy then goes off the medicine, he's got the same low threshold that he always did. I always think it's not psychological, it's really neurological.
Neurological, yes. Oh, see? Neurological, yes.
Exactly, you got me there. Yeah.
No, and also, can this help? It would probably be one of the PDE5 inhibitors like Viagra or Cialis that might help a guy with erectile dysfunction. But I think that's where he could maybe develop some confidence, or maybe you feel differently. Tell me.
Well, there's so many different kinds of situations. A guy who has psychologically induced erectile dysfunction, he just gets anxious with a partner, very often that guy can go off the medication once he's in a good relationship. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There are a lot of guys with what we call technically in the field shy penis. First couple of weeks, and then after that they're good. So that guy can taper off, and he can be fine without it very often. But the prematurity, it's different. That's how he's wired usually.
That's very, very helpful. So,
thank you.
Because we're drawing to the end of the program, I think about simple questions that couples can ask each other if they've, you know, they've read your book, and I have clients who've read your book with great effect and real help.
Thank you. Thank
and,
you.
And I'm thinking about two different couples that have bought the audio version.
Uh-huh.
And they listen on their long commutes, and that really helps,
wow,
too.
Okay.
Yeah.
The
I
had such a good time writing,
yes,
this book that it always makes me feel, yes, good if somebody has a good time reading it or listening to it.
Yes.
So.
Of course.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's meant to be fun.
It's meant to be fun, and so I think I like to suggest to the couples I see that you can think of sex in the same way you might think of other things that you do with your partner. So ask,
uh-huh,
questions like, was it enjoyable? Did you feel close to each other? How can you make it even better next time? And sort of in this spirit, I think you're less likely to worry about success or failure and more likely to appreciate what the rich range of experiences sex has to offer.
Mm.
Does that seem to resonate with... I think
it
does,
a little bit
based on...
I do it a little bit differently.
Okay.
What I prefer for couples to do, rather than,
mm-hmm,
ask each other, because that kind of puts people on the spot, is just tell each other.
Tell each other.
You know, this is like mindful,
right,
communications. Just, here's what I experienced. It was,
mm-hmm,
what it was. Here's what I experienced. And it's different various times. You know, they say you never step in the same river twice. It's always different.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell each other what your experience was. For me, I guess I'm a little different. I try and avoid the idea of how to make it better, because,
mm-hmm,
that is, the,
mm-hmm,
you know, it's a little bit like you go into a place of worship and you have a religious experience, and it was what it was. You know, sometimes you felt transported or moved, and other times it was just nice to go to church and see your friends. And that's all totally fine.
Yeah.
If you're saying, how can I make my religious experience better, you're kind of programming the thing, and to me that's a little too deliberate. So I guess,
mm-hmm,
I'm maybe a little radical that way. I think most people would probably agree with you, but I would you know, go a little more radical that way. I don't know. What
Dr.
do you think,
Stephen? That's my music, so that means the show is over. I'm going to try to entice
you
back.
So much, Diana. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and I'm going to try to entice you back. You are a wealth of information, Dr.
thank
Snyder.
Thank you so much. All right.
It's just
talk
such a pleasure to do this program with you. Bye-bye,
thank
everybody.
You.
Tune in next week. Bye-bye.